Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the biggest issues in improving American education is ensuring that every child gets off to a great start in elementary school. So school readiness is a very big issue. My guest today says one of the most important ingredients in being ready to learn is the skill of self-regulation, or executive function. Now, executive function doesn't fully develop until adulthood. It's one of the reasons adolescents can be so impulsive. But the first big spurt of growth in executive function happens during the preschool years. And my guest today has developed a curriculum to address this growth spurt. Dr. Deborah Leong is a professor emerita of psychology at Metropolitan State University of Denver. She's also a research fellow at the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers. And Dr. Leong co-developed the Tools of the Mind educational curriculum, which emphasizes self-regulation in preschool and kindergarten age children through the development of intentional, mature, make-believe play. This make-believe play is very important. She'll explain why. She was a guest of the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Lecture earlier this month. Now, we missed her while she was here, but she joined us today by phone to explain how make-believe play spurs executive function in children, as well as the latest research on the issue. Deborah Leong, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your work is centered on developing executive functions in children at a very early age. And what exactly is executive function? Because when I think of executive function, I think of that part of the brain that doesn't fully develop until adulthood. It's the thing that makes adolescents so impulsive.
That's true. Actually, there's a growth spurt in this capacity, which is related to the development of your prefrontal cortex. That's a part of your brain that's right behind your forehead. And executive function is kind of like the traffic controller of your mind. It helps you to pay attention. It helps you to remember things short term so you can think about them in your mind. It helps you switch attention from one thing to the next. So it keeps you from being totally reactive and helps you to be an intentional thinker, intentional reflective thinker. And young children start off, of course, being very reactive. They don't have those skills, and those skills develop in about the first 7 years. Mm. And then there's another bump up in adolescence.
Has anything changed in the way we rear our children that has affected executive function, say, in the last generation or so?
Yes, there is. One of the things that has changed is the fact that children don't play, don't engage in really mature, make-believe play like they used to. And that, it turns out, is one of the major places where children learn how to be regulated. So let me explain a little bit about that. There was a really interesting study done in Russia in the midst of World War II, and they asked a group of children to stand still, and they had three different conditions. One condition, they asked them to stand still, just the experimenter said, please stand still. The second condition, they were asked to pretend, remember this is World War II, that they were guarding a munitions dump, and would they please stand still. And then the third group was asked to stand still as they were playing soldiers with another group of kids. So they did this with 3, 5, and 7-year-olds. And 3-year-olds couldn't stand still no matter what because they're 3-year-olds.
Yeah, they're 3-year-olds.
Right. Yeah. But 5-year-olds could stand still almost twice as long under the condition where they were playing than when they were just asked to stand still. And the children who were 7 are able to stand still no matter what. So what this shows is that there is some quality of play that encourages children to develop because they're pretending to be someone more mature than themselves. They actually are able to control their impulses much better. And so nowadays we have, you know, families where children don't play the way we used to 20 and 30 years ago, where your parents would throw you out on the street and lock the front door and have you played in the neighborhood with all your friends. That's a pretty typical childhood for most people, even people who grew up in New York City,
right,
in the middle of the city.
Yeah, you played stickball and you had all sorts of rules, and all of a sudden the broom handle becomes a bat.
All of that helped us to develop self-regulation. And so in a lot of ways, we built school on this self-regulation that children developed because they played with each other and they had this life where they played by rules and things like that. And nowadays, you know, little kids are on video games. And video games aren't completely awful. But I'm just saying that because they don't have the other kind of play, there's nothing to balance it. So my favorite story is my son always wanted a Nintendo, and he's now 29. Uh-huh. And I rented one when he was about 7 to see what was so great about it. And I started playing it, and Mario would die in the first 3 seconds. And he got so frustrated with me, he finally said, "You know, Mom, if you could just stop thinking and press the buttons, don't even look at the screen. If you do that, Mario will live a lot longer." And you know what? He was right. Thinking got you into big trouble with Mario. But it just shows you there's so many things in children's lives in the past that really were asking them to be self-regulated. I mean, you went to church and you had to sit there. There were no children's services. You couldn't leave the table at dinner. So there are a lot of things that we did as families that really reinforced the development of this executive function, self-discipline, self-control, whatever you want to call it.
And you mentioned the fact that our school model is built on that model of self-regulating, and that kids that don't have that ability to self-regulate, that puts them behind the eight ball when they begin school.
Right, it really does, because you can't learn as quickly. So it's not that you can't learn without self-regulation, it's not very efficient. Because without self-regulation, you can't make your mind bend to learning something. You only learn if it's repeated hundreds and hundreds of times. And it's also the reason there are lots of social problems in classrooms now, where children fight and grab toys and hit each other and things like that. For one of the reasons they do that is that they lack this ability to control themselves. So instead of, when they see a toy they want, instead of thinking, "Oh, I should ask him for that toy," or "I should wait, it'll be my turn next," they don't think. So we say they act first and think afterwards. That leads to all sorts of negative social interactions because they don't stop and think.
Now, I would think that has to be learned at some point. Is that learning about taking turns and about the fact you can't grab a toy out of another child's hand while they're playing with it, that's something you learned prior to coming to school?
Yes, it is. What's interesting about executive function and self-regulation, it isn't that the children don't know the rules. It's just that at the moment of where you're supposed to enact the rules, they can't stop their first reaction, which is to grab the toy. So often these little guys, you'll ask them after they've hit somebody, "What else could you do?" They can list everything they could have done. But at the moment when they had to decide whether or not they were going to hold themselves back, they can't stop themselves. They act first and then think after. Whereas what children who have good social skills do, they think first and then they act. So, yes, it's true they should learn this at home. And a lot of them have learned those rules or how to behave at home. It's not that, it's the inaction of that at the moment when you should be doing it that's the problem.
And we're talking, this is the sort of idea of self-regulation, which some people call executive function, which mm-hmm. has been a bit the heart of your work.
Mm-hmm. You know, that one of the studies that was done that shows this pretty obviously is the marshmallow test. And there's a new book out about that, about being able to delay gratification, to wait.
Now, explain the marshmallow test for us.
So in the marshmallow test, children were asked to sit in a room with a marshmallow in front of them, and they were told if they could wait, they could have two of them. But if they didn't, they would just get the one that's in front of them. It's a great YouTube video if you look up the marshmallow test. But what happened is they found that children who were able to wait at 4 had higher academic scores on their SATs and better grades. As adults, this was done in the 50s, I think, 60s, and they were more likely to have a job, a stable marriage, all kinds of things like that. The research study has been criticized because, of course, when you get a study that goes on that long, you lose a lot of the subjects in the study. But it was a study, and the children were Stanford University faculty children. But still, it's, I think, a very interesting thing to contemplate as a parent, this ability to wait rather than to be gratified immediately. It had your ability to talk yourself into doing that had long-term consequences.
Interesting. Now, when we talk about self-regulation, we might sometimes confuse this from obedience. Now, what's the difference between self-regulation and obedience?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I think that the behavior that children enact may look the same, like taking a turn or waiting and asking a child for something or being able to pay attention and ignore distractions. But the difference is obedience, you're doing it because the teacher, you're compelled to do it because of an outside force, the teacher, as opposed to self-regulation when you're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And you do it regardless of whether or not there's an adult there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, all those kinds of things where you obey the law even though there's no policeman there.
That's right. You stop at the stop sign.
Yeah, you stop at the stop sign. There's nobody there, but you still stop. And so this ability to self-regulate, especially when it comes to attention and remembering things, it really has to be self-motivated or the learning itself doesn't last as long.
Now, a big part of your work and research is about modeling, too. So let me, since you brought up stopping at the stop sign when we're with our three-year-old in the car, is it important to stop at the stop sign as a modeling behavior, or will children really not get things like that?
No, I think that's important.
Yeah.
Of course, they learn by watching you.
They might ask, why are you stopping when nobody's there?
Yeah, I think that ability to regulate yourself really important. A lot of times we don't make those things explicit to children, but obviously being a model for them about why you do things is really important.
I've been hearing a lot of talk about research into parenting, in which parentings are, you know, because there are so many devices out there in which the devices can babysit the children, whether mm-hmm. it's, you know, the smart toys that do all sorts of things, or screens of all types, from television mm-hmm. to iPads to apps and everything. And there's a whole sort of range of people going back to parenting, basic parenting, of talking to children, of modeling for children. And this is a big part of what your work is about, too.
It is important because it's a different kind of interaction. So what happens with the screen is that you can be, it's really entertaining you, and it's outside of you, so it's not really, especially for young children, I would argue that, you know, like the kinds of games that older kids play that are like SimCity and things like that, that is different because there's a strategy involved. You have to really think. But a lot of games and screen time things for young children, they just really entertain and pass before the child's eyes, so it doesn't really encourage the thinking part. That's why interaction is so important, because you can ask a question and then you wait until the child responds. And then your response is contingent or depends on what the child's response is. So it's a much deeper kind of interaction than just having the screen read something and then it reads it another thing and another thing. It's going by really fast and isn't allowing the child to stop and think. That's the big thing about self-regulation, is this ability to stop the mind and think about what's going on and then reacting.
Now, I think a lot of parents, once those kids get conditioned to the screen, it's difficult for them to, say, play a board game or, again, with lots of rules in which you have to do that stop and think sort of behavior, or make-believe play. Is there any research that's telling us that those screens are harmful to that, to developing that type of play, or can kids turn it on and off pretty easily?
I think that I'm not really up on all that research on the screens. I do know there is negative research. Parents do have a hard time getting play going. A lot of parents may not have played on their own.
We all grew up with television.
That's coming up now and are being parents. We're screen-driven children also. I think part of the problem with play is that unless children have great ideas of what to play and have a play mentor, which is somebody who models how to play, they have a hard time getting scenarios going that aren't these really aggressive kind of pow, pow, pow things where that, you know, they're pretending to hit everybody. So if parents really want to encourage play, then they have to provide this fodder, this creative thinking for play. And one of the problems is that children are kind of dropping out of the stream of life, I like to say, and that is because we don't take them on errands anymore. And when they go on errands, they're often being occupied while you're on the errand, and not the errand isn't used as something that you think of as play. So an example is, you know, children play people. They don't play things. So when you go to the grocery store, most children now sit in these carts that are in front of the grocery cart, instead of my son sat right up in front with me. And so we would talk as I was shopping, and he could see all the people in the store, what they were doing. Another example is you take them to a restaurant, and parents immediately just want the kid to be occupied instead of talking about who the people are in the restaurant and what they do. Even in a fast food restaurant, parents are more worried about keeping their children occupied than seeing that as an opportunity. So for young kids, fours and fives, they play the people they see around them. And if we do things where they don't watch anything except a screen, then they don't even know much about how to play. I don't know if that makes sense. But some, you know, even parents put their kids in front of a TV while they're cooking. Little kids don't know much about what goes on in the kitchen. Whereas when before we had television, they had to sit there, so you were more likely to put out a bunch of pots and pans so they could play with you. As you're stirring this, they're stirring that. That's what my son used to do.
My guest today is Deborah Leong, a professor emerita of psychology at Metropolitan State University at Denver, and she's the former director of the Center for Improving Early Learning and now the executive director of Tools of the Mind, which is actually a resource that's being used in many places around the country, including our CAP Early Learning Center here in Tulsa. She was a recent keynote speaker at the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Series on early childhood education. And there's a bunch of research about the tools of the mind process of learning, which is showing increased academic performance once kids get from preschool into first and elementary years. And a lot of it's based on this make-believe play. Now, explain exactly how make-believe play is important to developing self-regulation. How does it promote self-regulation?
It is really the first activity where children actually really self-regulate. Because if I ask you, would you like to sit down, you're not really regulating yourself. You're doing what I asked you to. Mm-hmm. So in make-believe play, children play a role. And that role has a set of rules. So if you're the mommy, you feed the baby and you do this and this and this. And if you're the baby, you do another set of behaviors, but they're not the same. So what happens is by agreeing to be in play with other kids, and you agree, I'm going to be the mom, I will act that way, and I'll resist acting another way. So if there's a puzzle that I really like to play with, but I'm the mom, moms don't do that, I don't play with the puzzle. So it helps, the child has to inhibit other behaviors to be in the role of being the mom.
Yeah, and make-believe play in another way is it automatically comes with a set of rules. In fact, the rules can get quite elaborate for kids.
Very elaborate. And it's the discussion of these rules, and as play becomes more and more mature. So that's one thing I forgot to mention, and that is not all play is equal. So if children are running from center to center and throwing things in the air and pushing children over, that's not the kind of play that's going to develop this executive function. To be that kind of play, you're right, there are rules for what's going to happen. They discuss the scenario ahead of time. I'm going to have a sick baby, and you're the doctor I'm bringing in to you, and you're going to do this and this. And then we do that, and then we plan another scenario. So each scenario has a set of rules. Each role has a set of rules. In kindergarten, our children play the Magic Treehouse story, which is a time-traveling brother and sister, and they turn the room into this magical place. They travel to the Middle Ages and to ancient Egypt and the Ice Age. It's a wonderful set of stories, mm-hmm. and children get so engaged in that. And in the midst of all of that play and the planning of what's going to happen to this Jack and Annie and reliving the adventures, they predict more things. They learn incredible vocabulary because they use that vocabulary to describe the things that they see. So that make-believe play, that mature make-believe play, is what helps children self-regulate. for the first time.
Yeah, I was really struck by you using the example of, like, you know, a mommy and a child. Maybe one child wants to be the dog. And so then all of a sudden, not only do you have all the rules, but to keep everybody happy in the make-believe play, you have to adjust roles so that you're including the dog in whatever's happening. Or that child says, okay, I'm not going to play anymore, and the dog gets up and walks off.
Right, right.
So but there's also something important about that, because all the other actors are having to adjust to a child being the dog.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Being able, so that's that cognitive flexibility. So you change, you add that idea into the mix, and you make it work.
Mm-hmm. So, I thought that was really interesting, and I could see how this adds to developing self-regulation.
Yeah, and I think the tricky thing is that they need a play mentor of some sort. So for most children, parents are the first play mentors. But you don't want to take over the play, because then it becomes an adult-directed activity. So when the adult is a play mentor, they have to go in and out of the role of contributing ideas and helping the child learn by modeling how you modify a scenario. And then on the other hand, you have to step back and let the child also say what they think should happen in the scenario.
And then once you've modeled it, it's almost like they'll take off on their own.
Yes.
And you don't have to do it anymore.
You know, a lot of parents, when you have play dates, what parents do is they have some activity for children to do, but not play. And so I really would advocate for parents, when you have a play date, have the children play. Let them build a fort in your kitchen with kitchen chairs and blankets and things, just the way we used to do it. And they can play instead of having to make something.
Right. Yeah, I remember, picking up a stick, and the stick was all sorts of things.
Oh, yeah, that's really important. One of the problems kids have today is what you were saying before.
A stick is a stick.
Yeah, or that all the toys are so specific. My niece once, I came to visit, and I said to her, well, let's play Barbie school. And she said, no, I can't. And I said, why? And she said, because this Barbie that she brought with her is Ariel, and she's a mermaid, so she doesn't do school. If you want to do school, we need to go down to Target and buy Barbie school, or whatever
yeah.
that was. So that's why Legos are so wonderful. You know, toys, blocks,
yes.
You know, things that you can turn one thing into something else instead of it only being the thing it is. So this symbolic, that's another aspect of play that's so important, is it's symbolic substitution, and you keep repurposing props. So today the stick is this, and the next day it's something else, and the next day. That kind of substitution is a lot of people believe is the beginning of reading, because after all, reading is just a substitution of symbols, sound symbols, to stand for words.
My guest today is Deborah Leong, a professor emerita of psychology at Metropolitan State University of Denver and the executive director of Tools of the Mind. She was a recent keynote speaker at the OU Tulsa Seed Sower Series on Early Childhood Education. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about some parental activities. One would be, you mentioned pretending to cook, you know, where you're cooking dinner and the child, maybe a 2 or 3 year old, has got a pan and she's pretending to put the basil in the pasta sauce and stirring the pasta sauce as you're doing this. Another thing is perhaps parents showing a child how they're making their grocery list and take the kid to the grocery store and make a whole game about picking up the things you're going to pick up on your grocery list.
Right, and talking about the people. It's really important to talk about the people that are in this place, because when they go back, then they can play that. You can say things like, did you notice what the waiter said to us? He said, what would you like to eat?
Uh-huh.
And then he said, okay, I'll bring it to you right away. Gee, another thing that parents can do is discuss the kind of social problems that happen in those situations. Like, you go to the doctor's office because you're sick, and you can use that as something where you talk to the child about what the people in the doctor's office do and what they're going to say to you. And then you go home and play that very same thing by saying, so what could we use if we wanted to play doctor's office? What are the things that we could do here at home? Oh, this could be the waiting room. Let's make this the waiting room. This could be your chart. let's pretend this is the chart. Here's a pencil. You can, and I'll pretend I'm the mommy with the sick baby, and you be the doctor, and you're going to tell me things of what to do, and you can discuss it ahead of time, and then actually do that.
Well, let's talk a little bit in our last moment or two about the latest research, because there's just been some new research about this approach in early childhood education and how it affects elementary performance. What are we finding about this approach, in including this in the preschools and in early learning centers?
Well, the research study was done by Clancy Blair and Sabelle Raver. They're two neuroscientists at New York University, and they looked at children in our program that were in kindergarten, and they measured their levels of executive function at the beginning of the year, at the end of the year. The study had both middle class and at-risk children in it, and what they found is that we had an effect on levels of executive function, positive significant effect. We had an effect on literacy and math development at the end of kindergarten. And one of the two most interesting things is that there was no summer loss at the beginning of the next year, as well as the fact that by the end of first grade, after they'd already graduated from, they were no longer in our program, the actual rate of learning in the Tools of the Mind children accelerated compared to the control group. So in other words, the rate of learning was faster at the end of first grade than even it was at the end of kindergarten. And I think the last piece of interest to people is Dr. Blair and Raver are experts in something called toxic stress, which is children who have come from very chaotic backgrounds, family backgrounds, and usually are in neighborhoods that are very high poverty and have a lot of violence. And we were able to actually show the lessening of toxic stress in those children, and that we had the physiological markers of executive function as well as the behavioral markers.
Mm. And it sounds like that gives them a leg up that's going to carry a lot further in their academic life as they continue through elementary school and middle school years, because they have this sort of background of thinking before acting.
Yeah, there's a lot of research, not just necessarily on our program, but that executive function is a better predictor of later achievement than IQ, social class, or your parents' education. So that means that if we can help at-risk children develop executive function, you can close the achievement gap for them and help them learn better and more efficiently. And, you know, and I should also say, it's not to say that every middle-class child doesn't need self-regulation also, because I know a lot of children, all kinds of children, who are really quite smart, but because they lack executive function, they get in trouble in school, and they have difficulty learning. And once you can change that, you do give them a leg up for the future.
All right. Well, Dr. Leung, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Early childhood education researcher Deborah Leung speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's a professor emerita of psychology at the Metropolitan State University of Denver and the founder and executive director of the Tools of the Mind educational curriculum. She was a recent guest of OU Tulsa for their Seed Sower lectures on early childhood education. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.